Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morphin.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons.
We dive into a variety of cases in both the U.S. and abroad.
Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders or the canal murders.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime, like the Tylenol murders and the Lindbergh kidnapping. We also dive into cases that are currently breaking thanks to DNA and forensic genealogy.
Sometimes you'll hear from people connected to the cases, like the interview we did with the brother-in-law of the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo.
There are 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now, including full seasons covering the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
You're listening to Citizen Detective, brought to you by Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime, and Scene of the Crime. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Some quick thank yous need to go out before we get started. First, to our amazing podcast hosting platform, Spreaker. We're on their Prime program, and their dynamic ads help allow us to put the show out. Thanks to CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event and convention. Thanks also goes out to WebSleuth.com, the gold standard in sleuthing mysteries online. And finally, and most importantly, thanks to you, the listeners, and our citizen detectives. Your support means the world to us. And now on with the show.
Citizen Detective is recorded live alongside real-life citizen detectives.
Welcome to the premiere episode of Citizen Detective. I am Mike Morford. My friends call me Morph. I host or co-host a variety of true crime podcasts, including Criminology, The Murder of My Family, and Missing Persons, as well as Zodiac Speaking. If you want to call in and leave us a voicemail to share a theory, provide a tip, ask a question, or just tell us how cool you think we are, we'd love to hear from you, and you can do so by going to speakpipe.com/citizendetective. And with that, here is Nama Cates.
Hello, Citizen Detectives. I am so excited to be here with you tonight for this maiden voyage, our inaugural episode. My name's Nama Cates, and I'm host of the nefarious, notorious podcast, Incel, among other things. I can't wait to solve some crimes with you. So follow us on socials at CitizenDPod on Instagram and Twitter, and find us on Facebook, join our group, like our page, at Citizen Detective Podcast. Now, Doc, over to you.
Doc, that's me, Dr. Lee Meller. I am the VP of the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases. I've written 7 books last time I checked, and I host the podcast Murder Was the Case. And I want to encourage you to stick with us through this podcast. And if you enjoy it, which I think you're going to, please go to patreon.com/citizendetective and donate, become a supporter of the show at any tier, really, and you'll see the benefits there. With that, I'm going to get to the dark heart of the matter, take it back to Nama. Nama, what case are we looking at?
Kentucky Derby Day is a big deal in the South. Parties, fundraisers, and celebrations are in full swing. On May 3rd, 2014, in Eatonton, Georgia, a retired couple was hosting a derby party at their home in the luxurious resort community of Great Waters on Lake Oconee. When two of their friends failed to show up as expected, the couple phoned for days with no answer. They eventually went to check on their friends at their nearby home, where they discovered a grisly scene, a headless male body in the garage of an otherwise spotless home. One of their friends had been murdered, and his wife was nowhere to be found. 10 days later, her body was discovered floating in the lake, 5 miles from her home. After an exhaustive investigation utilizing every possible resource, police turned up no leads as to who murdered the elderly couple. Now, 8 years later, the killer, or killers, have still not been caught, but the investigation has not stopped. New technology may be the key to solving this mystery that haunts Lake Oconee to this day.
Eatonton, Georgia is the seat of Putnam County. It's located about 80 miles southeast of Atlanta. Eatonton is part of Georgia's Lake Country, home to both Lake Sinclair and Lake Oconee. And as you drive into downtown Eatonton, you are transported into a world of idyllic rural charm, and it's greeted by farms, Victorian homes, churches, and antique stores. Lake Oconee itself covers 30 miles and 19,000 acres with 374 miles of shoreline. The lake is man-made. It's a reservoir filled in 1979 by the building of the Wallace Dam on the Oconee River. And the average depth of the lake is 21 feet deep, but it's as deep as 102 feet in areas near the dam. This lake is so vast that it touches three counties, Putnam, Morgan, and Greene counties. And many parts of the lake are filled with underwater trees that were submerged with the release of the dam. Water sports dominate Lake Oconee in the summer. Every lakefront home has a dock on the water. The season's boat rentals, angling, and other activities bring a heavy influx of non-residents into Putnam County, its population nearly doubling to 45,000 during the warmest months. Eatonton also contains a luxurious resort community of Reynolds Plantation on Lake Oconee. Reynolds is divided into several smaller gated developments containing more than 1,500 homes and nearly 4,000 residents, many of whom live there only in the summer months. The community weaves in and out of 21 miles of walking trails, six professional golf courses, four marinas, and one of only 100 Ritz-Carlton hotels in the world. And Reynolds itself is considered an extremely safe community with a very low crime rate. There hadn't been so much as a burglary in 20 years prior to the crime we will be discussing tonight. And tonight's episode takes place in the most exclusive subdivision of Reynolds Plantation, known as Great Waters. Now, Great Waters contains approximately 600 luxury residences built around Lake Oconee and a professional Jack Nicklaus-designed golf course. Although many Great Waters residents live there full-time, approximately one-third of the population only live in Great Waters during the summer season.
Saturday, May 3rd, 2014. The Kentucky Derby was gearing up for its 140th historical run. California Chrome was the favorite to win. Race day celebrations were underway all over the South, and Great Waters was no exception. Residents Peggy and Huell Wynn, a retired couple in their 70s, hosted a Derby Day party for their friends and neighbors. One couple was missing, however. Their good friends, Russell and Shirley Dermond, were expected to attend but never showed up. Peggy called the Dermonds for several days after the party, but no one answered the phone. Peggy grew concerned, and finally, on Tuesday, May 6th, at approximately 10 a.m., she and Huell went to the Dermond home to check on their elderly friends. The Dermonds lived less than a mile from the Wynns. Peggy and Huell entered the property through the driveway, from the road leading to the garage and back door. Peggy knocked on the door multiple times, but no one answered. The door was unlocked and the Wynns entered the house, seeing nothing out of place. The house was pristine. They made their way through the house and eventually out to the garage. Huell Wynn glanced into the two-car garage and saw nothing. The Dermonds' nude-colored Lincoln Town Car and light blue Lexus SUV were both parked where they always were. Huell went through the house a second time, but this time he descended the steps into the garage. Behind the two cars, in between the vehicles and garage doors, he saw the headless body of a man lying in a pool of blood. Peggy called Putnam County 911 from the Dermond home. She reported an emergency and that she thought someone was dead. Suddenly, the dispatcher heard her yell, "Oh my God. Oh my God." The 911 dispatcher asked Peggy if there was more than one body in the house. Peggy replied that there was one body and that she did not know where Shirley Dermond was. 911 dispatched an ambulance and sheriff's deputies Daryl Turk and Barack Wood to the Dermond home.
The Dermond home was located on a one-acre parcel at 147 Caroline Drive. They built their home in 1999 at the back of the development in a cul-de-sac overlooking Lake Oconee. According to several real estate websites, the more than 4,000-square-foot home is a tan stucco with four bedrooms, six total bathrooms, hardwood floors, and vaulted ceilings. Although the house isn't currently on the market, Zillow and Redfin list the value of the home at more than $1 million. The house was uniquely built with the front of the home overlooking the lake and the back of the home facing the driveway and road. The front of the house opens onto a sloped area going down to a private dock on the lake. The yard's secluded, it's surrounded by thick forest, and it's neither easily visible to neighbors nor accessible by any roads or paths. In fact, the only way to the lakefront side of the property is by boat. The house has a closed, attached two-car garage located at the back of the house at the end of the driveway. Russell and Shirley were moderately vigilant about their home security. According to their children, they regularly locked their doors and set their alarm at night. The Dermans had a functional security system at their home, but their son Brad told police that it wasn't connected on Easter weekend in April, and it wasn't connected on two occasions in the weeks before the crime. We do not know why the system wasn't connected or how it came to be that way. We also do not know whether the system was connected on the day of the murders.
Let's take a moment to get to know the victims. Russell Joseph Dermond was born in Hackensack, New Jersey in 1925. He was 88 at the time of the murder. Russell stood 5'5" and weighed 182 pounds. He served in the Navy during World War II and married his wife Shirley in December of 1950. Russell spent most of his career as an executive at the General Time Corporation, a clockmaking company. He retired at age 58, after which he went into the fast food franchise business. He eventually built a small dynasty of 19 Hardee's restaurants that he sold to two of his sons in 1998. Shirley Wilcox Dermond was born in 1926, also in New Jersey, making her 87 years old at the time of her death. She was 5'3 and weighed 177 pounds, according to her autopsy report. Shirley attended Barnard College in New York. She was an avid writer and artist. In her later years, Shirley suffered from health issues that made it difficult for her to climb stairs or walk long distances, including being able to easily walk to the lakefront of their home. Despite her infirmities, Shirley enjoyed their retirement life, playing bridge twice a week with friends and gardening. The Dermans were very active in both their church and community and have been described as nice, normal folks, well-liked by all. The Dermans had three sons, Brad, Keith, and Mark, and a daughter named Leslie. Their son Mark was shot and killed on his 47th birthday during a drug deal gone wrong in August of 2000. The family moved to Atlanta, Georgia during the 1980s and built their Lake Oconee home after selling the fast food business in 1998. The couple was not excessively wealthy, but they were well off. They were frugal and worked hard over many years to build their small fortune, enabling them to enjoy a secure and leisurely life in retirement. They spent their summers with their children and grandchildren, the whole family enjoying the spoils of their lakeside home.
Sheriff Howard Sills of Putnam County leads the Derman murder investigation. According to the podcast True Crime Garage, Sills is a cigar-smoking, cowboy hat-wearing, no-nonsense lawman. Sheriff Sills is a seasoned veteran of homicide investigation. His career in law enforcement spans five decades. He trained at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and has reportedly solved every homicide he worked during his extensive career, which included five death penalty cases. By 2014, Sills had been on the job in Putnam County for 25 years. At 10:09 a.m. on the day when the body was found, deputies Turk and Wood arrived at the Derman home with Chief Deputy Russell Blank, Lieutenant John Murphy, and Sheriff Sills arriving shortly thereafter. Sills fully expected to find a murder-suicide. What they discovered was infinitely worse. There was no sign of forced entry. The inside of the house remained untouched. The house was immaculate with no evidence whatsoever of a struggle or disturbance. The kitchen revealed the only real clues as to when the murder occurred. A USA Today crossword puzzle was on the kitchen table, partially solved and folded neatly with a pencil on top. On the kitchen counter was a newly filled prescription belonging to Shirley Dermond, and a Netflix movie waiting to be returned in the mail. An open laptop sat on the dining room table with a pair of glasses in an open case nearby. We don't know whether the glasses belonged to Russell or Shirley. Further investigation revealed that nothing was stolen from the Dermond home. Shirley's two purses and cell phone were still on her vanity, and both contained cash. Russell's wallet and cell phone were also present and accounted for. Shirley's jewelry bag was out in plain view for anyone to see, yet nothing was taken. The only things missing from the home were Shirley and, of course, Russell's head.
The victim's driver's license indicated that the body belonged to Russell Dermond. The ID was later confirmed by a fingerprint comparison with Russell's prints on file with the U.S. Navy. The body was lying supine, or on its back, between the Lincoln and Lexus. At the time of his death, Russell was wearing a faded red t-shirt that was pushed up above his belly button, and blue and white striped boxer shorts that were soaked in dried blood. A pair of L.L. Bean slippers was found close by, to the side of Russell's body. The body was lying on top of a bunched-up bathrobe. Russell's bare feet were blood-stained. His hands were also bloody and showed bruising. Closer examination revealed a deep laceration on the palm and index finger of his left hand. Strands of hair were enmeshed with the blood of the wound. Some sources claim that the hair was Shirley's, however, we've not found any official records that confirm that assertion. The perpetrator removed Russell's head along the line of his t-shirt collar. At the time, Sills believed that whoever decapitated Russell did so with multiple clean cuts and knew what they were doing. As we stated previously, the victim's head was nowhere in the house. It appeared the killer, or killers, had taken it with them. A blood trail led through the garage from one of the doors to the body, indicating that Russell had been dragged several feet to where he was found. There was a large pool of dried blood on the floor of the garage, near the body. Blood and other fluids had also pooled at the top of the body, near the decapitation wound. There was no evidence of blood spatter other than the pools of blood on the floor of the garage. Towels were on the floor, at the bottom of the garage door and to the left of Russell's body, placed as if to prevent blood from seeping outside and onto the driveway. More towels were on the right side of Russell's body. After searching the home, investigators learned that the towels belonged to the Dermans and were taken from one of their bathrooms. Behind the Lincoln Town car, Sills discovered a spot on the floor where something round had been sitting in blood, then removed, leaving a clean, negative space in the blood pool. According to Sills, the clean spot was larger than the size of a human head.
The entire house was dusted for prints. If any were recovered, police haven't released the information. Police used luminol, the chemical agent used to detect blood invisible to the naked eye, on the entire house. The only place they found blood was in the garage. Police didn't find any weapons in the home. According to Sheriff Sills, they recovered some additional forensic evidence from the scene. However, these details have been withheld from public for investigative purposes. Sheriff Sills moved forward in the case on the presumption that Shirley Derman had been abducted and that her life was in imminent danger. Police dragged the lake near the Derman's dock. They brought in canine units to search the area and used cadaver dogs around the house. Police searched the entire lake by boat, sonar, and with a submersible robot. None of these efforts produced any results. Neither Shirley nor her husband's head were anywhere to be found. Missing person posters and billboards went up around the area in hopes of bringing attention and leads about Shirley's whereabouts to the case. No resources went untapped. The FBI came in to assist in the investigation, putting up a $20,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest of a suspect. As of 2019, the reward was up to $45,000. Sheriff Sills consulted international law enforcement agencies and even a few psychics, desperate to crack the impenetrable mystery surrounding the murder of the beloved Great Waters residents.
Russell and Shirley's days prior to the murder were filled with your average routine activities. On Thursday, May 1st, Russell ran errands in town. At 2:15, he went to the Lake Oconee People's Bank drive-thru to pay their long-term care insurance premium. Next, surveillance footage showed Russell at the Publix grocery store at 2:26 p.m. There, he picked up a prescription for Shirley, a loaf of bread, and some cucumbers. He chatted with another customer in one of the aisles of the grocery store for a bit, after which he checked out and left the store. That same day, Shirley Derman attended her biweekly bridge group at 12:30 p.m. At some point before the dinner hour, the German's son, Brad, phoned his parents, as he did regularly, and chatted with his father. On Friday, May 2nd, a neighbor saw Russell walking along the golf course. The time when this occurred is unknown. Russell had been an avid golfer, but gave up the game due to his age and physical limitations. Instead, he took up walking for exercise and enjoyed taking strolls along the beautiful golf course. That Friday was the last time either of the Germans were seen in person, but other events indicate that they were still alive until at least Saturday, May 3rd. Shirley sent an email on Friday, May 2nd. However, we do not know at what time or to whom. The USA Today crossword puzzle that was sitting on the kitchen table and had been worked on was delivered on Friday the 2nd. The German children told Sheriff Sills that their mother always did the crossword on Saturday morning, which was May 3rd, the day of the party. The German's mail carrier confirmed that he delivered their mail at 4:30 p.m. on Friday, and Sheriff Sills, for reasons he's not revealed, believes that the Germans brought their mail in that day. Sheriff Sills is convinced that the murders occurred between 4:30 p.m. on Friday, May 2nd and 4 p.m. on Saturday, May 3rd, when Russell and Shirley were expected to be at the Wynns for the Derby Day party. The German's bed was unmade, which, in addition to Russell's clothing, a faded t-shirt, boxer shorts, and robe, led Sills to believe that Russell was either getting ready or had just risen from bed at the time of the murder. According to their children, Russell would remain in his shorts and robe until late in the morning, unless he had someplace to go. During the initial investigation, there were no reports of anything out of the ordinary on the German property or in the surrounding area. None of the neighbors reported seeing any strangers on or around the property or heard anything that disturbed the peaceful ambiance of Great Waters. Later, a neighbor did report seeing someone around the German's home, and we'll talk about that briefly when we get further along in the investigation. Based on what he observed at the crime scene, Sills does not believe that what happened to the Germans, aside from the decapitation, happened anywhere on the inside of the house. He does believe, however, that there were more than one assailant. As he told 11 Live News, "There's no way one person did this. I'm not going to say it's absolutely physically impossible, but it's highly unlikely."
10 days passed, and police still knew nothing about either Shirley's whereabouts or the location of Russell's head. Finally, on Friday, May 16th, the dreaded news came. Shirley Derman was dead. 53-year-old Dennis Higgins and 65-year-old Ronald Sorreo were fishing on Lake Oconee near Wallace Dam when their boat neared some of the many underwater trees that populated the lake. The location was approximately 5.5 miles from the Derman home. The trees were in one of the deepest spots in Lake Oconee, measuring about 46 feet deep. The only access to this area is by boat. As they approached the trees, they saw something in the water tangled in the standing timber. As they got closer, they saw that it was a body floating face down. One of the two men immediately called 911 to report the discovery. Lieutenant Harry Luke, head of the Marine Patrol Unit for Putnam County, responded to the scene by patrol boat. Sheriff Sills and FBI Supervisory Special Agent Carlton Peoples joined him, also by boat. At 3 p.m., Putnam County deputies pulled the bloated, decomposed body from the lake. The body was that of a female and had swollen to twice its normal size. The woman was fully dressed in brown, green, and tan short-sleeved floral shirt, green capri pants, and white size 8 Easy Spirit lace-up shoes. Investigators were unable to determine the cause of death at the scene, but it was clearly a homicide. Two red concrete 30-pound cinder blocks were tied to the woman's ankles with multicolored 550 paracord in an attempt to weigh her down in the water. The cinder blocks were enclosed in a bluish-gray mesh bag. Investigators determined that with the weight of the cinder blocks, the body could not have moved and floated more than 100 yards to end up in the trees.
Medical examiner Dr. Sandra Thomas of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation performed the autopsy on Russ Derman on May 8, 2014. The autopsy showed that Russell had been dead for several days. Dr. Thomas estimated Russell's date of death May 3, 2014, the day of the Kentucky Derby party. The body's decomposition was minimal as the process was slow due to the air conditioning in the garage. Russell's injuries are listed as craniocerebral injury, not otherwise specified, and hemorrhagic crush injury of the left index finger, with lacerations of the palm and finger. Additional contusions were found on both of Russell's arms. The ME found gray hairs on both Russell's hands and on his shirt. Again, we have no information regarding the source of the hair. The report lists the cause of death as craniocerebral trauma. The ME determined that the decapitation was performed post-mortem. The head was severed with a single clean cut at the C5 vertebrae. This finding contradicted Sheriff Sill's initial determination that the killer required multiple cuts to complete the decapitation. According to multiple sources, forensic investigators found gunpowder residue on the back of Russell's shirt collar. The residue led Sills to believe that Russell was shot in the head and that the head was taken as a forensic countermeasure to conceal ballistic evidence. Dental records confirmed that the body of the female found near Wallace Dam was Shirley Derman. GBI medical examiner Dr. Jonathan Eisenstadt performed Shirley's autopsy on May 17, 2014. Shirley's head had one V-shaped laceration above the right ear. The arms of the V were 1 1/4 inches in length. A second V-shaped laceration, 2 inches in length, was found near the first. Skull fractures underneath the lacerations were in a semicircular shape, consistent with a blunt instrument like a hammer. The body showed no signs of sexual assault. Shirley's feet were tied to the cinder blocks with the parrot cord that was wrapped 3 times around each ankle. There was no bruising around Shirley's ankles. This finding led the ME to conclude that the body was weighed down in the lake post-mortem. The autopsy report lists Shirley's official cause of death as blunt force trauma to the head, and the manner as homicide.
Sheriff Sills launched an extensive investigation that spanned over other jurisdictions and even other states. His investigative team scoured the Durmans' phone records for odd or irregular interactions, but nothing stood out to him. They canvassed the neighborhood, speaking to over 200 people, and none of them had anything helpful to report. As we mentioned previously, one neighbor reported seeing a man on the Durmans' property on Saturday, May 3rd. Her house was relatively far from the Durmans, and she wasn't able to distinguish any of the man's physical characteristics. For all she knew, it was Russell Durman himself. Surveillance footage in the area was reviewed, and again, nothing out of the ordinary turned up. Russell and Shirley only had two domestic employees, a gardener and a laborer. Both employees, as well as members of Shirley's Bridge Club and the Durmans' church, were investigated, questioned, and polygraphed. And still no leads emerged. Police thoroughly investigated and polygraphed the Durman children, leaving them with the belief that they were not involved with their parents' deaths. Police reviewed all of the Durmans' financial records, finding nothing out of the ordinary, other than the fact that neither Shirley nor Russell had an ATM card. Putnam County records show that in 2012, the Durmans reported an incident of credit card fraud. Police don't believe this incident had any connection to the couple's murder. Investigators checked with the residents and the boat rentals in the area, inquiring if any boats had been stolen. Whether or not they learned of any thefts is unknown. Security at Great Waters was relatively lax. There was a 24-hour guard at the front gate. There were cameras installed at the community's main gate, but the system was broken by a bolt of lightning approximately a week before April 28th. There was no arm across the driveway at the shack and no barrier to automobile entry. Residents were permitted past the gate based on vehicle stickers. Workers used passes to gain access to the community. Golfers and visitors were granted access to the community and its amenities with minimal record keeping. There's no security on the lake side of Great Waters. Boaters can bring in their own boats or rent one and access the shore, avoiding security measures altogether.
Police have turned up very little new information in the years since the Durmans were murdered and have made no arrests on the case. According to WSB TV 2 Atlanta, Putnam County had a person of interest approximately 1 year after the murders. At the time, Sheriff Sills told WSB TV 2 that they did not have enough information to consider him an actual suspect, including evidence of a motive for the crime. In 2014, Sheriff Sills told 11 Alive that he believed that the murders might have been the result of a botched robbery and extortion plan, the perpetrators killing the couple when they were unable to provide the robbers with the money or valuables they were expecting. In 2015, information was revealed pertaining to a mystery man spotted on the Durman property around the time of the attack. Sheriff Sills questioned the man but did not arrest him. It is unclear whether this was the same man we discussed previously who was spotted by the neighbor on the Durman property. Sills has explored several theories and is always looking for cases with details similar to the Durmans. In May of this year, Sheriff Sills revealed that he has received new cell phone data, and he's confident that data will shed light on the Durman case. The FBI is currently assisting Putnam County in analyzing the new evidence. No other details about the information have been released.
Russell and Shirley Durman are survived by their daughter, Leslie Patton, their sons Brad and Keith Durman, and 9 grandchildren. To this day, Russell's head still hasn't been found, and his exact cause of death remains unknown. The Durman family is relying on Sheriff Sills, the FBI, and members of the public to uncover the details of his parents' murders. If you or someone you know has information regarding the murders of Russell and Shirley Durman, please call the Putnam County Sheriff's Office at 706-485-8557. Tips can also be emailed to tips@putnamcountysheriff.org. Now, let's bring in Dr. Lee Meller to give us his insights into the Lake Oconee double murder.
This is what I'm going to be doing on the show. So let's start off here. Typically, I'm going to be doing behavioral evidence. It's the kind of thing that we use when leads run dry or police get stuck. But in this case, I really would be derelict in my duty if I didn't go right to DNA collection. Now, I understand that there's been no DNA evidence collected, but look, what do we know? We know that Russell's body was moved. Even if it wasn't dragged across the garage, there was certainly some manipulation of the body during the decapitation. So it's strange to me that we don't actually have any DNA evidence. In fact, there seems to be a lot of interaction with the body. The clothes are there. They would have been touched by the offenders. And so, Sheriff Stills, I'm speaking to you. You've got to get an MVAC. MVAC is great. It's like a wet vacuum. And instead of just swabbing little bits of Russell Derman's clothes, it's going to spray the whole thing. And then it can lift off and get like minute traces of DNA. I'm pretty sure if you get an MVAC and you MVAC Russell Derman's clothes, you're going to solve this case. Now, just in case you don't, I understand you're stuck. You need some leads. Let's look at what I call a couple of crux clues. Those are clues that if you interpret them and analyze them properly, can really lead to the possible resolution of this mystery. They're clues that they're like doors that once you get them open, everything else is pretty easy from there on. And in this case, it's the fact that Russell was decapitated. That's unusual. But also that Shirley has not been left in the house. She's been murdered. But it's like there has been different treatment of each victim. So those are the things we really need to focus on here to go about figuring out, well, what is it that was motivating the offenders, and what does that tell us about the offenders? Let's start with the decapitation. There's typically about six types of motive for any type of mutilation. Decapitation would obviously fall into that category. So the first is rage. You're angry at someone, and so you cut their head off, frankly. But in that case, you'd expect the head to be left too, right? It's something else to get so angry at someone that maybe you cut their throat so hard that their head comes off, but why would you take it with you? That doesn't go to the anger motive. So I'm ruling that one out. There's also the paraphilic or fetishistic motive. So that's some sort of deviant sexual gratification. In this case, I would think it would be something necrophilic along that spectrum. But we don't have any other signs whatsoever that this is a sex crime. I mean, both victims are clothed. And if you look at the victims themselves, we've got a couple in their 80s here. I've heard of sex crimes committed against people that old, but never with this, with like a paraphilia that pronounced. So I'm going to rule that one out too. It could be psychotic. So if somebody's having a full-blown schizophrenic episode, going through some sort of delusion, and then therefore whatever it is that's within that delusion or that episode motivates them to cut the head off. Perhaps they think it's the only way to kill the demon, something like that. But you heard the crime scene. It's really clean. This is not consistent with somebody who's that psychotic. If somebody is that out of control, the rest of the crime scene is going to be all over the place. And we don't have that. So we can rule all those out. What about something ritualistic? Is it some sort of black magic? Well, that's really rare. That's something you see on TV. In fact, I'm not really familiar with any cases that involve decapitation and of a couple this age and home invasion and a ritualistic motive. So that's just highly improbable. There's no other symbols, any sort of pentagrams or candles or anything that would lend itself to you thinking that that's some sort of religiously or motivated crime. So that one, yeah. That's out too. So what does that leave us with? Well, there's an expressive transformative motivation. That's like something symbolic. So I'll give you an example, and I'm sure this crossed a lot of your mind. It's like, I take the head because then I can take it to someone and say, look, I've delivered to you the victim, or you can take the head and you say, this now is in my possession. I've reduced you to this little bit. I conquer you. You know, the Conan the Barbarian stuff. But before we get to that, I mean, that's, once again, it's pretty rare with a couple this old. Why don't we go to defensive mutilation, which is actually fairly common? So this is defensive mutilation, which doesn't go to the signature. It doesn't go to gratify the offender. Instead, it addresses some practical part of committing the murder, trying to get away with it. All right. Well, that did come up, and we heard that there was some gunpowder residue on Russell's collar. And so I think that defensive mutilation in this case is the likeliest explanation. In fact, I would bet a whole lot on it. What happened was that Russell was probably shot one or more times in the head. And we'll talk about how that came about in a bit. And then the perpetrator realized, okay, there's ballistic evidence now lodged in the skull. So we can't leave that behind. And so the decision was then made to remove the head. So that's what we're going with. And according to the autopsy reports, it is made with a single cut. We don't have any information of anything in the Dermans' house, like a sword or a giant butcher knife, missing. And so I think we can assume that whatever tool was used to commit this deed was brought to the crime scene. But a single cut, that is something. And I think the likeliest candidate is a machete. And what does that mean? So we have, where is this leading us here? We've got organization. We've got forensic awareness. We've got a machete brought. Before we go to sort of like a profile or leads on that, let's look at the other crux clue. Shirley is not treated the same way as Russell. She is abducted from the crime scene. It's either that or she's killed at the crime scene, and then they take the body and they have some idea of doing like a botched ransom plot, but then they decide against it. They're probably thinking on their feet in the moment. And so we've got to resolve this conundrum too. You'll notice that I'm saying they. That's not to be neutral. I think that there was certainly at least two people involved in this. The level of control exhibited at this crime scene is really pronounced. If this was one person committing this, you would expect there to be a lot more evidence left around. It would be sloppy. And I just see that there's far too much control. I mean, Shirley is tied with these cinder blocks and taken out into the lake and weighed down. So we're looking at, you know, two, three, maybe four people involved in this crime. So what is it? How do we explain this? Well, I'm going to go with a robbery gone wrong. You probably found it hard to believe that Russell and Shirley Dermond didn't have ATM cards. I did. And so would anybody who was breaking into their home premeditatedly with the idea of taking the ATM cards and passwords from this elderly couple and then extracting all this cash. And so can you imagine you get into the home, get the couple under control. Okay, give me the ATM cards. We don't have any. Yeah, right. You have it. Where is it? No, we really don't have any. Especially if there's multiple offenders here, you can imagine, at least one of these people, that driving them to be really agitated. And I think somewhere in this dynamic here, they lose control of the victims. I imagine they're controlling them at gunpoint. And with the unexpected drama playing out, things go awry. And I believe this is when Russell starts to fight back. He's got defensive wounds. Maybe he's attacked. Maybe he sees the writing on the wall, the way that these guys are acting. And so things escalate, blow up. And so at this point, Russell is shot in the head. I think probably because it's on his collar when he's turning to flee or something like that. At this point, the perpetrators make the decision, okay, well, we've got to deal with this. He's dead now. We've still got one still alive, but we got to get out of here. What if somebody heard the gunshot? Okay. Well, they're thinking on their feet. Take her. We'll get the information out of her later. We got to get his head off. We got to get out of here. So you could see how this happens. They're still probably thinking they really do have ATM cards or ATM passwords, or maybe now they're trying to switch, as I said before, to like, we've got to salvage something from this. So let's turn it into a ransom situation. With that, what do we know about the perpetrators? Well, they seem to know the lake pretty well. And I doubt it's because they reside on the lake. That doesn't present itself. That's a very high-risk crime to reside on the same lake. Particularly, it would have to be in the Great Water Subdivision, because they're not just aware of the lake. We know that because they used a boat and they put Shirley's body at a very deep spot, but also because they're aware of the Dermans. They know these people have a lot of money. So it's either someone who lives in the Great Water Subdivision or nearby, or it's someone who comes and goes frequently. So I'm thinking somebody who works there, maybe in like a maintenance capacity, somebody who installs windows, fixes roofs, landscaping, plumbing, whatever it is, a frequent visitor who services the homes or the property of the Great Waters Subdivision. And then they may even have a passing like, hello, Mr. Derman, hello, Mrs. Derman, that sort of relationship. And so when we put that together with this forensic awareness, the sort of steel and resolve to plan this crime and carry it out, and the knowledge of the lake and the machete, this is really important. Sheriff Stills, I would say, if you're looking for leads, if you really want to go, where do I proceed from here? I'd be looking at workers or visitors who go to the Great Water Subdivision frequently and have ties to organized crime, most likely Latin American or Caribbean in nature. I say that because of the machete. If you type in machete attacks, that sort of thing, into Google, you're going to see an overwhelming representation from those demographics. And it's Georgia. It's geographically makes sense. And so with that, I am going to invite Morph and Nama back to discuss what I gave there. I know it was a lot, but what do you think, guys? Morph?
It's just a very puzzling case. It's one of the weird ones. And I think that's why we went with this case out of the chute, because it is popular among the citizen detectives out there. And so many possibilities. You hit on some good points. Can't overlook that the fact their son was murdered in some kind of drug deal. Now, of course, that could be just totally a weird coincidence, but I also wonder if he moved in some circles that perhaps someone even down the line said, hey, remember the Dermans? Let's go see if they still have some money and see if they're an easy target. Or, you know, we've been to that house a few times. You know, we know the layout. Maybe they'd be an easy mark. You know, so I wonder, and I know some of the citizen detectives have looked into that angle of could that be connected to that case. It's for me just kind of hard to overlook the possibility. And I don't know, unless the case is solved one day, I don't know if that can be proven. But it makes it seem like there might be some smoke there.
Yeah, I agree. And it crossed my mind. And I think it just stands to reason that you've got to look in that direction. Also, you do have to look at family. I believe they did. I believe they cleared the family. So I'm just trusting that they did their job right. But yeah, Morph, I mean, that certainly pops. At the very least, it perhaps shows that despite the wealth, that the Dermans couldn't isolate themselves from some of the more unsavory organized crime elements in the area. So, and at worst, you're right that the people that were somehow involved with the killing of their son might have revisited them 14 years later. It's chilling stuff. Nama, any thoughts?
Well, that jumped out to me too. Of course, the drug connection, though I do think 14 years is a long time for, you know, something that happened with a son in a drug deal to, you know, later revisit them that way. It's possible that maybe one of the other children had some kind of a drug habit or something. Yeah. And it's just this exposure to that element. I did wonder if you had any thoughts about, well, one, the fact that it was, you know, Sheriff Sills believed that everything took place outside of the home. What are your thoughts about that? Because I thought that was interesting.
I mean, he has access to evidence that we don't. A picture is worth a thousand words. You get to look at the crime scene photos. But that's a lot of blood to come from a postmortem decapitation wound, the way that they describe it. They also talk about there being blood on Russell's feet. Well, how did that get there? It's like he stepped in blood. Okay, well, probably not if it went into the grass. And if it was on the porch, we would have heard about that. If there's that much blood outside, you're going to find it. So I think that Sheriff Stills, you know, unless I can see photographic evidence or he's holding something back that I don't know about, I think that, no, it didn't all happen outside. What I would imagine is they could have been confronted outside. But it's sort of like a we have a gun, get into the house deal, and probably managed to usher them into the garage. And at that point, they're still in control. Control is lost in the garage, and I think that's where the bulk of the violence occurs. That much blood is not going to come from a post-mortem wound, even something like a decapitation. It would come from there is a defensive wound on Russell's hand. Okay, so that possibly the same implement, the machete, I think, something like it that was used to take the head was employed there. That's going to cause bleeding. But you know what? A gunshot wound to the head, that certainly is. That's going to bleed like, you know, nobody's business. So I agree with you, Nama, that I think Stills is wrong on that one. Morph, I know you got to have some more thoughts. What do you think about the whole machete angle and, you know, the instrument? That's what makes sense to me. If we're going with like a sword or something that seems farcical, I can't imagine a knife where you could take someone's head off with one chop. It has to be something with some weight, right? Something sharp.
Yeah, I'm thinking something with weight as well. And although I had some machetes, and I think it would take, unless, again, I'm not a knife expert, I'm a machete expert, but based on my machetes, I couldn't see one swing, one hack taking someone's head off. I think it would take a couple blows. Again, you're severing through the spinal column and stuff. I think a sword would be more likely, but I'm picturing someone coming to the scene with a sword in their, you know, in some kind of case on their back. It almost doesn't seem logical that someone's going to arrive like that. So I sort of go back and forth on, well, is it a machete? Is it a sword? Is it something else we're not thinking of? It just a really weird, you know, manner to behead someone like that. And it'd be one swing or one hack, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, unless the pathologist or medical examiner, whoever did that finding, was wrong, because Still said multiple, like you would expect multiple. But that, I who are you going to go with? I'm going to go with the medical expert. So yeah, we got to go with one chop. And as you said, someone showing up with a sword, that's ridiculous. It's not like it can happen, but is it likely? I think, you know, also you saying, well, my machetes aren't that sharp, I can't imagine it happening. Imagine someone who has really practiced with machetes, who taken heads off before. That's why I went with the Latin American, possibly Caribbean organized crime angle. You know, I don't like saying it because it has a connotation of, oh, you're picking on the little guy, but I'm sorry, that's what I see. Most people, I don't think, are taking heads off with single blows, but maybe in other parts of the Americas they are.
Yeah, and I wonder if it, you know, along that line, I wonder if they checked different staff to see if anybody had something in their background that maybe was from one of those areas or had been exposed to that kind of stuff, or, you know, had family members that were involved in that kind of stuff. I wonder how closely they looked at everyone, you know, in that development, and different caretakers, people that moved around there, to see if there's anyone with that kind of connection in their background.
Well, that's what I was getting at. And if I didn't state that, I was just a little bit of first show jitters, but that was kind of what I was getting at. You want to look at the people who are showing up to do the type of work I described, even security, right? But it's not necessarily who they are. It's also who they know. And so it doesn't mean necessarily you're looking for like a Latino guy or anything like that. It could be anyone with a connection to that world, whatever that may be. Do you see really a single perpetrator pulling this off? To me, it seems.
Yeah.
No way.
I mean, to me, this does shout like cartel, like Central American gang cartel, because it's just so professional and so cold, so organized, and so kind of violent, as you mentioned, that I don't see this being any other kind of criminal. I mean, I don't know that much about the way those criminals operate or choose their targets. And that's why checking in with the staff, with anyone that was familiar with the grounds and the people would probably be a very important step. But, we said that they weren't tremendously wealthy. So the fact that they were targeted, I guess, is it just opportunity because they're an elderly couple, maybe?
Well, I sort of look at, the cartels. Again, I'm not an expert on cartels, but for the most part, they have a set business. You interfere with that business, you cross them in that business, you could pay the ultimate price. Hmm. I don't typically see them going out and saying, right, hey, let's go attack these old people.
Yeah.
That, to me, unless, again, it's just some rogue element just looking for an easy mark, you typically don't see that. So it sort of clashes a little bit with what we know about them.
What if it could have been anyone? What if it could have been the couple next door, the elderly couple next door on the other day? Like, what if it wasn't like, oh, specifically these people look like they have a lot of, maybe they did. Maybe they look like they had more money than they did. I'm going to say, all these people seem like they've got a lot of money to me. And I think the cartel is going to see it the same way, but they're not going like, okay, well, that couple there's got a million, but they've got 3 million. They're just eyeballing it and they're going them or someone who's working there, the type of person I described, comes back and they say, hey, listen, I think that we've got a soft target here. Mm-hmm. I went and cut grass or did windows, or I was cutting grass and windows for someone else. And I noticed this old couple and they're there early. Right. I mean, this isn't the middle of summer. Maybe there's not a lot of other targets around. We talked about the seasonal nature of this. And what I also want to get to as well is, why take Shirley? And for me, it's either we'll get what we want out of her, the information we want out of her later, or damn it, we've got to salvage something from this. This went sideways. Let's turn this into a ransom plot. And then they think better about it later. And one of those two or both.
And yeah. I know cartel have kidnapped people and, but to me, I don't know. I don't get the vibe of it. Just something seems off. It seems like they, if it was an execution over some kind of drug connection or something, I see them both being killed right on the spot. I also go back to whether it could be one person or more than one person. I wonder, from what I understand from the reading that I did, that he was in pretty good shape for his age, but he's still up there in age. So I wonder how frail his wife was. If he was taken out immediately, could the attention be turned on to the wife pretty quickly and done by one person? I wonder if that could be a possibility. And again, we don't have access to all the evidence, the crime scene photos, the little clues that the investigators have. We don't have access to all that, but I'm curious if there's anything that might tell them if it's one person. It, obviously, he mentioned he seems to think it was more than one person, so maybe based on what he sees, there's more than we're made aware of. But I wonder, due to their age, if it is entirely impossible that one person could have done this crime.
I feel like even if it were possible for one person to do it, I don't think one person would approach this and attempt this because it was so organized. There was so little blood spatter. There seemed to be so little struggle. And even if one person could have theoretically pulled it off, I don't think they would have attempted it because this person seemed organized and seemed to know, how to.
And behavioral, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at, well, what is the probable thing? Or, so it's possible that someone could have done it, but it's very improbable. We've got to keep in mind, too, that not only was the initial murder and home invasion and that amount of control perpetrated at the crime scene, but then Shirley Dermond is taken seemingly by boat, right? I think it's fairly obvious by the fact that there seemed to be no information from the main security gate and that the perpetrators knew the lake and they put her body down there, that, she's also taken in boat, maybe dumped right in, but probably, possibly also taken elsewhere. And you know, where's the ATM cards? Like, who do you know? Will someone pay money for you? That type of thing. So maybe held nearby too. And that's an important thing. Do you think that they take her away from the lake? So they drive her out of these exclusive estates and then they take her to some other holding place. And then when they have to kill her, they bring the body back to the lake to dump it in. I don't think so. I think that it's got to happen around the lake. So with that in mind too, maybe it is someone who lives on the lake or maybe someone who has like a facility, like a shed or some sort of outbuilding.
Yeah. And I think maybe some of the clues could be discovered by what Shirley was tied down with. Is this stuff that you would find on a boat that they just happen to have nearby? And that could indicate a spur of the moment decision, or is this stuff that they brought with them with the intent that you wouldn't find on a boat? They brought this with them with the intent to weigh down a body and get rid of the evidence. That shows a little bit more pre-planning and maybe not spur of the moment decision-making.
Yeah. Cinder blocks. Eric Ford, I think that was probably brought, right? I mean, that's not something you'd find laying around.
Yeah, I don't go boating with cinder blocks personally.
usually not a good mix.
Sort of like finding a ski mask and ice pick in the trunk of someone's car. What do you need that? So, but I mean, so many possibilities. It's hard to maintain focus. I've been having a difficult couple weeks leading up to this. I had to go to a behavioral analysis conference. Yes, I am legit, but yes, that is stressful. And at the same time, we're running drills for this show. And then I've got to also migrate all my stuff from my podcast, Murder Was the Case, over to a new server. And so I tried out this stuff, Magic Mind. And I got to say, they were insistent. You take this for 3 days, see if it improves your focus. And what can I say? I got through that bad stint. And here we are. So as far as how did it perform on the personal test with me, I think it went pretty well.
Yeah, I've been taking it now for, I think, 4 or 5 days now. And, you know, I'm working long days. You know, here we are. It's 10 p.m. and I've been at it since 9 o'clock this morning working on one thing or another. And I, you know, it gives you a little bit of focus. Hard to describe. I feel like I just keep going and sort of as I'm reading, as I'm writing, as I'm researching, I just have this focus that lasts throughout the day. So I've noticed a benefit from it, and I think it's something that I'm going to continue to keep using because it seems like it makes a difference.
Yes, I have been having it too. I've been having it for, I believe, like a week now. I'm having a little bit now with my coffee. Sometimes I have it in that. Sometimes I have it in peach iced tea. It tastes pretty good either way. I find that it helps me with my patience in a weird way and like my temper. And it has these nootropics called ashwagandha and rhodiola rosea. They are something that keeps your cortisol levels down, so your stress levels. So I think that might be what it is. And it really helps me stay in flow. And you are citizen detectives. I know you're going to be working long hours too. So I think that it will probably give you guys the controlled calm boost that you might need. So check it out. Give us a try and let us know what you think. Head over to magicmind.co/detective and use our discount code detective20 to get 40% off your first subscription or 20% off your first one-time purchase. I think it only lasts 10 days, so go. That link is magicmind.co/detective and the code is detective20.
Co, not com. Okay, so we've got some guests for you, and the first guest, he's pretty special. He is a death investigator, formerly with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. You might also know him as the host of the podcast Autopsy, but most relevant, he was actually there when this whole thing was processed. I believe he looked at the bodies. I want to bring our friend Landon Wilson up as a guest. Landon, welcome to the first Citizen Detective. So you've been listening to us?
Yeah, well, not the whole thing, about the last 20-30 minutes.
Okay, that was sort of our breakdown. Any thoughts on that? Anything to add? Are we overlooking anything? Is there stuff that you know that we don't know?
I guess just briefly, like you said, this was 2014. So I was about 2 years into being a death investigator when this came in. And this is a case that, you know, you get dismemberments every so often. They're just crazy cases. You kind of want to be there. This wasn't my case. I was a death investigator and an autopsy tech, and I just was in the room that day for Russell's case. But I'm pretty sure, as I recall, I actually assisted with the autopsy for Shirley. Whenever I walked in for Russell's case, I think we already kind of knew sort of the gist of it. And just to sort of, when I was listening to you guys asking about the neck wound. So I walked in and I'm looking at it, and there's, you know, 3-4 people in the room. And I walk over to the doc and I'm like, "How you doing, doc? You need anything?" And she was like, no. She was like, "There's the case over there." She's like, "Come look at this." And I know that y'all have already gone over this, but this was just my perspective. Walked over and she's like, "Look at this wound." And there was, like you mentioned, there was other like smaller like wounds where it looked like they tried to do what they were doing and it didn't quite work. And I was like, "Okay." She's like, "Look at this wound." And you know, I'm a death investigator. I'm not a pathologist. I'm like, "I see it, doc. What am I looking at?" She's like, "I got to go grab another doctor to come look at this." She's like, "But I am almost certain this is one clean cut." And I'm looking at her and that's like a showstopper moment. Mm-hmm. That's a moment where you're just like, you never see something like that. I mean, dismemberments or beheadings are rare as it is, but you never get anything where the doc is just like, "This is one clean cut." And at a certain point, she did go get another doctor. They came down and looked, and they were just like, "Yeah, as near as we can tell, this is a straight cut right through the main cut that, I mean, he was likely, I think she did say he was dead. By the time this happened, but she was like, "Yeah, it went through the skin, the muscles, the bone, like the one of the spinal bones." I mean, like you said, it is razor sharp. And I would tend to agree, like, you'd be hard pressed to think someone would bring a sword to this case. Machete is more practical, but it would have to be pretty razor sharp. And you sit there and you stare at it and you just try to think like, well, why didn't they just like, if they knew they could take this guy's head off in one clean sweep, which I assume they knew they could, maybe they didn't realize, like, why would you even bother doing something that's more like hacky of what the other wound showed? Why didn't you just immediately go for the swipe? It was one of those cases that came in and, you know, you'll get a case like a weird homicide, even dismemberments, and you'll start reading through the case and everything. Usually when you start reading through the case, you talk to the detectives, at least something starts clicking where you're like, "Okay, I see how we got from A to B to C." But this was a case that the more questions you asked, the more you were just like, "What?" Like, that, none of that makes sense. And his case was done, I forget what day of the week it was. She wasn't done till 10, 11 days later. It was on a Saturday. I remember that because I was working late shift on Friday before and got the phone call. I don't know. This is more rambly stuff. I don't know if y'all care too much about
keep going.
Yeah. You're okay. Saying, but I want to follow up soon.
Sure. So Friday afternoon, it's late. Everybody's gone. I get a phone call. It's from the detectives. I don't think I took the case and like wrote up the report. I may have. I don't think I did. It's been so long. But they were calling. I think by that point in the day, we already knew they'd found her body. And we were waiting for them to call the case in to report. So when I answered the phone, I thought I was at least either I took the case or I thought I was going to. But the one thing I remembered that they said was, they're like, "We need the doctor that did Russell's case, can we please get her to do Shirley's case?" But that was more for, it helps with it helps streamline their investigation. It helps with, if anything ever comes to court, it helps with that. And I was like, I can tell you right now, she's not going to be here. Like, she was off that day out of town. I was like, that's not going to happen. And they're like, okay. But they were basically calling. They're like, well, what time? And I was like, be here. Usually we scheduled them. We'd usually schedule officers to be there at like 9 a.m. And this was, they were calling Friday. So Saturday we had a skeleton crew. So they wanted to make sure we could actually do it Saturday. I was like, well, this is a high profile. This is getting done today, tomorrow. So y'all be here at 9 a.m. We usually got there at 7, 8 o'clock and prepped and all that stuff. So by the time they came in, we could, if we had anything, we could show it to them. So I did assist with her case. And like you said, hers was a cinder block tied to her calves with paracord, and was with the doctor as he, you know, he was looking to see if there's like hemorrhage around the paracord when he was kind of cutting it off, and there wasn't. So we naturally assumed this was post-mortem, that she was weighted down. And, you know, we knew at that point something razor sharp had taken his head off. So we were expecting something similar. There were already the theories that maybe he was shot in the head. So maybe something like that, she was shot or stabbed or something, but she was beaten in the head several times. And it was just, again, everything that came up with this case were like, that doesn't make sense. And then the only other thing I have for this is, bear with me, it's been 8 years since I saw it, but I did see the scene photo. You don't forget that kind of stuff, a scene like that. Because when you see, again, like everything, when we have questions and we look at scene photos, you're looking for an answer, and nothing in this case ever provided anything. So, and including the scene photos, we sat there and went through them. And like, this is, I covered this case on my podcast, Autopsy, and I mentioned this then, and they took pretty thorough scene photos. Like, you're walking through the house and, you know, like you're supposed to, like, take a few feet, take a photo, a few feet, take a photo, your surroundings, that kind of stuff. And it just looked like nothing was touched. And you're just like, this is like, none of this makes sense, until you get to the garage and you see his body.
We're losing you a little bit.
Yeah. The audio's weird, dude.
Mm-hmm. It might be your connection.
It was good.
Yeah, it was.
Maybe we should leave it at that then.
Yeah.
I mean, we got your account of it. Maybe that's higher powers saying.
I did want to hear it was kind of right at the really good part that it started to cut out, but.
Yeah, I had a lot on my mind.
Yeah.
One of the things that we do is we do the scrum, which is sort of a more informal after hours. So when we finish the formal part of the podcast, we've got another guest to speak to. We're going to look at some of your comments. We're going to see if you sent anything on SpeakPipe. And then we're going to do like a little after hours part. I'll be around for that. And so, Lando, if you want to try and figure it out and you feel like sticking around, we can get to you then. I think that probably sounds like the smartest option for now.
I definitely want to ask him some questions, because mm-hmm. he was just piquing my interest. And it's everyone listening, that's the joys of doing live shows. You get all kinds of little funny surprises that we edit out later on in the final version.
Right. So with that, thank you, Landon. Hopefully we'll see you later.
Thank you, Landon.
Thank you.
Okay. This should not be a surprise, but he's certainly a funny guy. A friend of mine, homicide detective, and I know the first thing that came to mind with him was also the MVAC. Please welcome to Citizen Detective, Detective Cloyd Steiger. Cloyd, looking sharp as always.
Hi, thanks, guys. How you doing?
Hey, Cloyd.
Good. You got a piano since I last visited.
Yeah, you know, I moved up.
Yeah. So, Cloyd, we can solve this case, right?
I think we can. I mean, it's never guaranteed, of course, but I think there's a lot of stuff that can be done that probably hasn't been done since this happened. There's been a lot of advances in forensic science in 2014, and we should take advantage of some of those.
Yeah, I agree. And so we're talking about the MVAC. We're both on the same page there.
Right. Yeah. Because touch DNA wasn't really around in 2014, but it's very much around now. And you can get DNA off things that you couldn't get several years ago, but you can now. And one of the ways you get that is by using the MVAC wet vacuuming DNA collection system, which we both are very familiar with. But anything the suspect had touched, assuming they weren't wearing gloves, they're going to leave skin cells on, like the towels in the garage, the shirt of the victim. The woman, probably not, because she was submerged for so long. I mean, but you never know. You should try it. There have been cases where people were submerged before, and using MVAC, were able to get DNA out of them. But those are the first things I would do. If this was my case, that was the first thing I'd do. I'd say, we need to MVAC all the clothing or all the items that the suspects could have potentially touched.
Oh. Potentially touched. We know that they touched Russell. He was dragged through the garage.
Right.
The idea that they didn't manipulate him while cutting his head off is, so they did touch him.
But don't you think they've been wearing gloves because they seem like so professional?
Yeah. I got to tell you, I don't see this as a professional case at all. I'm a big believer in Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is probably correct. And I don't see this as involving cartels. I see this as one or two goofballs who thought they could get money from these people in a rich neighborhood. And when they got in there, it didn't go the way they wanted, and it got out of control. I believe they shot him in the back of the head and then cut his head off to recover the bullet, and then took her away, whatever, hoping she could give them information, ended up beating her to death with a hammer and dumping her in the lake. Now, I believe his head is also at the bottom of that lake.
Yeah.
She floated up, right? But he wouldn't. His head has no place for gases. It wouldn't float. It would just sit like a rock at the bottom. It's down there. There's no question about that. And here's another thing. The allegation that I think the sheriff said that I think they were killed somewhere else and brought back. Absolutely not. Why in the world would you take them away, kill them, and bring them back and risk somebody seeing you and doing all that stuff? It's absolutely ridiculous. He was killed, shot in the back of the head in that garage, and beheaded. She probably wasn't killed there. She was taken somewhere else and then beaten with a hammer. And, you know, the thing is, don't overthink these things. Keep it simple. That's usually the way these things. You're going to solve this. But like I said, with the MVAC on the towels, they under his arms where they dragged his body, his shirt was raised up because they dragged him. That's where you're going to find touch DNA. And, you know, the thing is, they probably didn't think of that stuff back then. And so it's clearly a solvable case, in my opinion.
And Cloyd, for listeners, how many cases have you worked on in your professional career?
I worked about 250 murders.
And how many of them were beheadings or these kind of wounds?
Probably only two or three. Two or three. I mean, I've had total disembodiment of victims a couple times. I've had decapitations once or twice. It's not really common. It's pretty rare. Let me talk a little bit about the decapitation too, the one clean cut.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you'd have to bring a broadsword with you or something, right? Yeah. But if you had a sharp knife and continually cut without starting again and working your way through, I think it'll appear as one clean cut. Mm. Even though you're basically sawing through with a single edge sharp knife. It wasn't serrated. If it was serrated, they'd be able to tell from the wound, right? But they're just cutting through that seems much more likely to me than one lop. I mean, if you got nothing, it seems really unlikely. Or
Cloyd, where do you make that call? Where do you say, you know, the pathologist says this, but this time I'm just not going to believe it? Because I'm inclined to always say they're the expert. It's a single cut.
They are the experts. That's right. But the thing is, I would ask that if I was talking to the pathologist, I go, how do you know this wasn't a single cut with a single edge sharp knife that was sawed through the thing? Can you tell that? And they would probably say, no, they probably appear the same. That's my guess. I mean, I don't know that, but I mean, I handled a couple of dismemberment cases and, you know, you can tell, right? Especially, I mean, the thing is when they say one clean cut, that's because there's no other cuts other than the one that's in there. But if you start and continually work with a sharp knife all the way through back and forth, is that going to show something different? Sure, but I don't think so.
It would have to be very kind of perfect and steady for it to look like one.
You just have to start and not withdraw the weapon and start again. If it's continuous and you're working with, again, a sharp, smooth-edged weapon and just sawing back and forth, is it going to look different than, I agree that they weren't hacked several times and weren't sawed. The pathologist will be able to tell that, right? But but you start out clean edge and you just work your way back and forth. I'm pretty sure it's going to look the same as one single cut. They're looking for little skin tags, right? They're looking for tags where it's done and not done and in and out or try again. Yeah. And they don't see that. So it kind of is one clean cut, but it's got a lop.
One point of entry, we can call it that. One point of entry, we call it that. Yeah. Okay. So, Cloyd, we actually agreed on a lot of stuff. We agreed on motive. We agreed on them losing control of the crime scene, all that. Where we departed was you go just a couple goofballs. And I initially went in the direction of I think most likely you want to look at people who are working or visiting that area who might have connections to organized crime.
Oh, I don't like the organized crime part.
Let me explain what that means. I'm not talking the mafia, right? You might call it disorganized crime, right? Gangs or something like it. People have been jettisoned from that. So like MS-13, former MS-13 members, rogue members, something like that. I think,
You can have that. You can have that. But it's not, I don't buy the cartel thing because why would they bother with these people, right?
I think the one clean cut sort of takes that lessens that theory. For me, it was very much the idea of a one clean cut that made it something like organized crime. But if that's not the case, then that's out the window.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree with Lee. I'd call it disorganized crime because rarely, even MS-13 and those guys, they're not that organized, right? They're more, hey, let's go get those people. Right. I think somebody saw them, assumed they had money.
Yeah.
So I think you get money from them, got there, couldn't get the money. It got out of control and ended up killing these people. A terrible thing. But that stuff happens all the time.
And I'm curious, Cloyd, in your few cases that you did handle that were that kind of murders, did you solve any of them? If so, who did the culprit turn out to be? Yeah. Was it some kind of organized person or?
No.
Lost Cloyd's audio. Okay. Well, Cloyd, we lost your audio, buddy, unfortunately, but maybe you and Landon will both pop back. Why don't we have Cloyd step down? If him and Landon want to pop on later for the scrum, we'll bring them in. And I need to take a little bit of a break. So thank you, Cloyd, for being on the show. And so we'll just take a minute, bring up Alex and Ashley. Alex is a writer and researcher for the show. She did a wonderful job. I think you'd agree. And Ashley is a production assistant. They're going to come up and they're going to tell you something while we just take a little break. And we'll be back with you in a couple minutes.
Hello, citizen detectives. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Alex.
We hope you're enjoying the show so far. And we'd like to take a moment to tell you about becoming a Patreon supporter of Citizen Detective.
Sign up for our first tier, become a Nancy Drew, and get ad-free episodes, bonus content, and participation in the after-show scrum. Detective scrums will eventually be going behind the paywall, and we know you won't want to miss them.
Second tier support earns you the title of Columbo, and you will get all of the content in the first tier, as well as a guarantee that at least one of your comments will be read or your voicemail played in the main show or the scrum.
Third tier access includes all of the content and benefits of tiers 1 and 2, access to a quarterly private session. What we mean by that is that Thal will gather online to interact directly with one or more of your hosts, an unsolved case not covered by the main show.
Finally, our fourth tier earns you the premier status of Sherlock Holmes. This tier includes all benefits of the first three, as well as a VIP pass to any special in-person events where you will be able to hang out with the hosts of Citizen Detective. In addition, we will reveal other new and exciting benefits as we go that will only be available to our top tier supporters.
So head on over to Patreon. Citizen Detective streams every 2 weeks on YouTube, at CityPod on Twitter, at Citizen Detective Podcast on Facebook, and twitch.tv/Citizen Detective. We hope you will join us and become part of our detective agency.
And kudos to everyone behind the scenes, Alex, Ashley, And we can't forget Drew. He's putting all the tech stuff together and making this flow and doing it all live, which, you know, I don't know about you guys, but this is a new experience for me, sort of interacting here with people. And I can't wait to get to the Citizen Detective comments and theories and you know, if they've left any voicemails, it's going to be interesting to see what they think about this case.
So I lit a victory cigar. I think it was all right. Why don't we do that now? Why don't we go to some of the Q&A comments? We're going to put up three. We'll see what, obviously there've been more than three comments. We'll get to some of the others in the scrum probably, but let's get our first comment up here. Drew, Lori Green says someone knew the house. They knew right where to get the towels to block the bleeding, or if they were in a rush and had the luxury of time to look for them. Yeah. Well, to me, that shows more forensic aware. Okay. It's like anyone can think, oh, that blood's going to leak out of the garage. We should stop that. That doesn't take a genius, but I kind of disagree with Cloyd. I think these guys have more of a criminal history because I believe they kill Russell. They don't want to, but they lose control, as Cloyd said. I said it too. And then it's like they've got to shoot him. And then at that point, I think amateurs would flee. I think that they would get freaked out and just want to leave. And probably, you know, whether they take Shirley with them or not. So, yeah, the towels, that's a very good point. I've mentioned them knowing the house. I think that's pretty obvious. But, yeah, the towels to me show that these are people who are calm under fire. They aren't just dolts exactly. They may not be geniuses, but they're calm under fire. And that, to me, shows experience. Great comment, Laurie. Thank you so much. Let's get another one up here.
All right, so Melissa Perry George says, if they did come in on a boat, one of them could be an avid fisherman and have a really good fillet knife.
How avid is it to have a knife that sharp? Because I've never seen a fishing knife anywhere near that. But then again, I'm no fisherman.
Yeah. Those fillet knives are pretty sharp. They have to go through bone, and they have to go through thick, fatty fish meat. Now, the fillet knives that I've seen are pretty thin.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not a knife expert. I don't know about these injuries, but I imagine they're going to have problems getting through that spinal cord. And again, maybe Landon can fill us more in on that. That's probably more in his wheelhouse. It definitely seems sharp enough to do that kind of job. Although I just don't know if it would cut all the way through that spinal bone. That seems pretty, pretty tough.
If you get between the vertebrae, that's what I'm saying. I think the guys have done this before.
It could, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe you get that right spot and it just goes right through. And then all of a sudden you accomplish what you're looking to do. And that could point to stuff that they just happen to have on the boat. Is that stuff they used and they scrambled and said, okay, let's go ahead and use this and this, and we'll tie her down with this. It's definitely an interesting possibility.
You got it, Morph. And I know Nama wants to weigh in, but before that passes us, I was trying to address this to Landon before the audio crapped out. It's what if they tried some knives that they had on them, some edge weapons they had on them, that explains those initial little cuts. And they said, this ain't doing it. They went down to the boat. And if it wasn't a machete sitting in the boat, I think of, like, this is where I went. Remember Quentin Jaws? He had that big, was that a machete? It was a big slashing thing, but something they kept in the boat like that and came back and they said, that'll do the trick. Once again, calm under fire. You leave the house, you see the boat, you see your getaway.
Yeah. A knife. I mean, I think that, you know, it's to the comment. I think that it's possible that one of them might've been an avid fisherman and there's no reason to kind of rule that out or dismiss it. I don't know that it tells us that much more about, you know, the perpetrators, but I do think, you know, when you talk about whatever kind of knives they were using, the fact that there were these other wounds where somebody seemed to be trying something else before we had the clean cut, whether it was one cut or sort of a very steady sawing motion, I think to me that also kind of reinforces the idea of more than one perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know we talked a little bit about, is this a amateur or is this someone that's, you know, going to take off as soon as something goes wrong? I wonder, and I think, Lee, you mentioned that you seem to think that they weren't amateurs because they
sort of, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can correct me if I am, that maybe they had some kind of, they didn't panic and they sort of stuck to some kind of plan. I see it as I think pros would know when to hold them, know when to fold them and say, okay, this has gone south. Let's get out of here. Drop two witnesses right there and go. To me, I seem to think this is an inexperienced, or maybe they're criminals, just not to this extent. Mm-hmm. They've never dealt with something like this. And if you're good, you know, bringing someone with you after you've just murdered someone and beheaded them, and bringing someone else with you is only seems like it's going to create hurdles. So to me, I almost think the opposite. I mean, I think that they perhaps were some kind of not super experienced in this kind of level of crime. At least maybe they have other kinds of crimes. I don't see them being experts in this realm myself. But
well, yeah, there's
they might
there's
have been experienced but dumb.
Yeah, there's a degree between expert and completely incompetent, right? And that they're floating in there. And so they might have experience taking heads off. They might have done this before. But what they weren't expecting was for the whole situation to go south. Think of the movie Reservoir Dogs. The whole movie is based on a crew of professional, in that they've done it before, bank robbers, who then everything goes tits up and suddenly they've got to think on their feet and they've got different personalities. Maybe you've got the psychopath among them. Maybe you've got the calm, cool-headed guy. You've got one more who's out for himself. So you've got this variety of people saying, so that's another reason why they might not be making good choices at the time. It's not one person. You might have one person who's like a professional or seasoned in this, and he's got some other people with him that are not so professional. So yeah, great point. Let's bring up the third comment.
Yeah, and this one is from Hal Shore, and he asked, is touch DNA legit? I assume he's talking not in general, but maybe he is. Or in this case, is it legit that there may be touch DNA? In this case, I think he was.
Yeah, touch DNA is legit. It's too legit to quit. And so, Sheriff Stills, do not quit. Get the MVAC. Get more of that touch DNA. That is your quickest path to victory. Do that before you follow any of the behavioral leads that I've given you. And if that doesn't yield anything, start down the behavioral path.
Is there some controversy over whether it's legit or not? Is that
why? No, it's just the context, right? So if you have a rape that happens, let's say you have semen. Semen has a context. You have someone who was raped and killed, and then their semen provides DNA. You're like, well, that was definitely the person, you know, the person that did it, or one of the people that did it. It belongs to the perpetrator. The thing about touch DNA is that it could belong to someone who's otherwise touched the clothes, who didn't have any involvement in the crime. But it's still better to have that information than not. And if these guys are, can we at least say that these guys probably have a criminal history? Yes. At least one or two of them do, right? Okay. Yeah. So you get that touch DNA and then you run it through the system. Ping, ping, right. Ping, ping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm already thinking of another guest that we need to have at some point, and that's Jared from MVAC. At some point, we've got to invite him on the show.
He's running all over the UK right now, trying to convince police agencies in the UK to pick up the MVAC. How many times do we have to keep saying it? It's horrible. It's like, when they first found DNA in the 80s and people were trying to convince all the cops and they didn't get it until the 90s, sometimes into the early 2000s. Hey, this is a really important tool. MVAC is the next step in that. Please, if you're a law enforcement officer watching this, believe us. Cloyd, as you saw, he told me that he solved 250 homicides. Maybe he's being a bit cheeky with that. But we have experience in this. It is real. Touch DNA is legit and the MVAC will get it if there is any to be got. So with that, now I think we get to a pretty amusing section. Let's see how this goes. Did we have any call-ins from you? Did you go to speakpipe.com/citizendetective and leave any voicemails for us?
Hi guys, this is Hal calling from Longwood, Florida. I'm listening to your inaugural episode here, and I'm thinking about decapitation. I keep hearing it was one cut or one chop. I'm wondering if there was a second opinion on the autopsy, because I'm thinking, you know, we're talking about, is it a machete? Is it a really heavy, sharp object? I'm thinking one slice, as you know, when I cut up a steak, I can take a really sharp knife and slice through several times and it looks like a clean cut. Just wondering if you guys know if there was just one autopsy and if that was official, and if there have been a second opinion on that autopsy to see if it was one chop or was it sliced. I mean, it does sound very bizarre. Anyway, love to hear your feedback.
Wow. What a great first call. That was, it brings up a really good point. And, you know, we talk about ballistics in a lot of cases. They bring in firearms experts to say, okay, it was this kind of gun, it wasn't this kind of gun, and here's why. I wonder if they've gone down that avenue of bringing in knife experts, bringing in people that would know, people that are specialists with those kinds of wounds, to try and get to the bottom of what exactly it was. Because maybe that would help point in a certain direction. Maybe it's a special tool that some of the fishermen nearby use, something along those lines. So that's a really great thought-provoking call, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Landon would know. Right. And as far as second opinions go, I think it happened less formally, in that he spoke about how the person who performed the autopsy said, this can't be a single cut. Right. And went and got someone else that was in the know and said, yeah, it looks like it to me, too. So not in the formal sense, but certainly in the informal sense. But I think we've spent a lot of time addressing the cut. Nama, did you have anything you wanted to add, or should we move on to the next call?
Spent time on it, but I think that issue, if it's potentially not one cut, I think that takes an element of bizarre and mystery out of this crime.
I think that was our only call for so far. So,
left time for three guys. Yeah, come on,
call in. We want to hear your theory. We want you to pick our brains and get us thinking. And that's what we're all here for, is to come together and sort of crowd solve these cases if we can.
Get involved in the Digital Detection Agency, the DDA. You have been notified. So with that, shall we do a wrap-up, kind of closing thoughts on the case, and then we'll go to some overtime in the scrum. That'll be less formal. Before we do go to the scrum, I'm going to be there. It's sort of taken on that duty, so I'll always be in the scrum, almost always. Morph, Nama, are you going to stick around today?
Yeah.
I'll be there. Mm-hmm. I will be there, and I'm excited to see what we didn't talk about, if we can get to anything and maybe pick up again with Landon or Cloyd, if he's there, maybe pick their brains a little bit more, because I think they have a lot more insights that they can offer.
Definitely.
And maybe we have some more comments. I know that we had more than three comments. We only had the one SpeakPipe voicemail, but maybe we can check out some other comments in the scrum. So let's just sort of close this down. Is this something that we would revisit? Have we, like, right now I feel that we have done as much as we could possibly do. I you know, you start with the MVAC, you go for the hard science and it's there, and I have a hard time believing that they use something like that, advanced DNA collection.
Yeah, but this, to me, being like a crime of opportunity, or, you know, money or robbery, and not some kind of personal thing or not some kind of paraphilia, it's more about just the forensics and less sort of about people and theories and motivations. So I kind of agree. I think at this point, you know, it's largely up to the technology.
Yeah. And the MVAC is just one more tool in the tool shed for investigators to use. You know, it's not the only thing they need to use, but maybe they should, in conjunction with everything else. Because guess what? If they pull some DNA up, they can go back and say, okay, who's this belong to? If they can identify it, then they can say, why is your DNA here? And they can do a full investigation. See, is this someone they shook hands with, or, you know, brushed up against? Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they can always do that investigation and see, why is this person's DNA there? Is it just a random, you know, one, or is this someone that came into close contact with them?
Yeah. To rule people out.
Exactly. You can never have too much information. It can be overwhelming, but the last thing you want to do is run out of information. The best information you're going to get, whether it's to exclude someone or include them, is DNA evidence. And the good thing about probably not working with a sexual homicide type offender, you know, stereotypically we think a serial killer is, that if you get one person, it leads to the next and leads to the next. If you look at those, I suggested looking at people that were coming into the estate to work on the various properties, you know, chase them down. It might not have been them, but they might have tipped someone else off. Who are they connected to? And so once you get that initial lead on a person, you might not get the killer or even the person that was in the house. But what you do is you start a chain of finding people and getting to the bottom of the mystery. And without, you know, I think any more that we say specifically on this, we're retreading the same ground. So I'm good with leaving it alone. So we're going to do this two Tuesdays from now. This is a biweekly thing. We'll see you then. Different type of murder, different type of mystery. And that's what we're hoping to bring to you. I had a blast, particularly once we got going. I was like, yeah, we're in the pocket.
Yeah, it's like when you rebuild a car engine, you start it up and you have a little bit of backfiring, and then the cylinders catch and the fuel starts flowing and it gets a little bit smoother. And, you know, I think the team did a great job. I appreciate all the input and the great thoughts from our citizen detectives. And just, again, so you know, we record this and then we publish it the following Saturday, a nice cleaned up, polished version, if you will.
In audio
format. Yeah. So be sure if you want to go back and listen, it'll be a little bit more polished and clean. Obviously, when you're recording live, you're going to have little spurts of stuff, and that's live recording. But the finished product will be a little bit smoother and polished up. So that'll come out on Saturday.
I think we did great for our maiden voyage, and really looking forward to continuing seeing what kind of feedback we get, what kind of engagement we get from you all listening, because that is, again, like everyone said, I'll reiterate, the most exciting and most important part of this process and of this project is sort of the synergy that we can get going with our citizen detectives, our audience, and, you know, putting as many heads as possible is always better. More intelligence, more originality, more thoughts, more observations, more curiosity, more the better.
Exactly. Okay, Melissa Perry George said, great job. This was so much fun. Thank you. It was, it got fun for us, yeah. I think.
Yeah. It became and fun. I think as time goes by, we're just going to have more and more citizen detectives coming in and, you know, sharing their thoughts and really getting hooked in with us and sort of becoming a big team, which is the whole point of the show. We want to have a round table of different opinions and different ideas and approach these cases that way. So, great first episode.
And just, I agree with the spirit of everything more for Nama said, but Nama, this is a Georgian case. It's not you all, it's y'all. And so we'll see you all, y'all, in the scrum. And normally the scrum is going to be behind a paywall, but we want to give you a little taste for the first two episodes of this. So we're just going to go now. It's going to be available to everyone.
The Citizen Detective Team includes co-hosts Nama Cates, Mike Morford, and Dr. Lee Meller, who also provides case analysis. Writing and research, Alex Ralph. Technical producer, Andrew Gray. Production assistant, Ashley Monroe. Be sure to catch new episodes of Citizen Detective every other Saturday, wherever you listen to podcasts.